from Indiana to Connecticut today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Indiana's governor said no to Syrian refugees, and that sent one family to Connecticut instead.
I know that if they had come here, Indiana would have welcomed them like they welcome the 893 other refugees that we resettle each year.
Plus, France's right-wing National Front sees an uptick in interest after the Paris attacks.
I think a lot of people remember that National Front has warned them long time ago about the danger of immigration and Islamism in France.
And were Japanese Americans really a threat to the country during World War II?
It's a lie. It's an outright lie.
That's all coming up today on The World. We've seen Capitol Hill drag its heels on lots of lawmaking, but sometimes it can move pretty quickly. Today, less than a week since the Paris attacks, the House of Representatives voted to tighten restrictions on Syrian refugees coming into the country. President Obama is expected to veto the bill if it reaches his desk. The House vote directly follows what happened in Paris, where a Syrian passport was found near the body of one of the gunmen. That's raised fears that extremists could try to sneak into the U.S., posing as refugees. Americans are deeply divided on this issue. In a few minutes, we'll hear about one case where refugees did, in fact, turn out to be supporting extremism. But first, let's go to Indiana, where a Syrian refugee family was hoping to resettle. Instead, they're now in Connecticut. That's after Indiana Governor Mike Pence ordered a halt to the resettlement of Syrian refugees in his state. Carlene Miller is with Exodus Refugee Immigration. That's a group that was working to resettle that family in Indiana.
They fled Syria in 2011 and registered with the United Nations and were granted refugee status. And then they started the process with the U.S. in 2012. So they've been in the screening and vetting process for 3 years. We received their information a few months ago and accepted them as a case to come to Indianapolis, and then got a heads up a few weeks ago that they would be arriving yesterday.
And what happened in Indiana?
Well, on Monday, our governor made the decision to attempt to block refugee resettlement of Syrians in Indianapolis. And Tuesday morning, I received word from the state that the governor had instructed them to tell us to cease Syrian resettlement and that they would not be able to provide services to them. It was, you know, the first Syrian case to come into the U.S. after the governors had started making these statements. And so we weren't really sure what would happen to this family. And there was a lot of interest in this family from media, et cetera. And we were really concerned that this family needed to get the services they needed and not be caught up as a political football in this situation, as they were, you know, coming here as refugees and had been traveling for 48 hours to get to the U.S. And so we made the decision to have them transferred to one of our network offices in Connecticut, who we knew would be able to welcome them the way that refugees should be welcomed.
So this family had been thoroughly screened, you say, and vetted. Why was Indiana Governor Mike Pence still concerned?
You know, I think that he is operating on misinformation and a knee-jerk reaction to not understanding the very thorough screening process that we have in place in the resettlement program for all refugees coming into the country. Refugees are the most screened people that arrive in our country, definitely more screened than tourists, and they go through extensive background checks before arriving. They even have a face-to-face interview with Homeland Security before they get to the U.S. This is, you know, parents with a small child who are fleeing for their lives. And as a country, this is what we are about. And this family needed to be received with open arms.
Yeah. How does this make you feel that they haven't been received with open arms in Indiana?
You know, I am really disheartened by this. This is very painful for us in the resettlement community, and we're also really angry. And we, you know, want to stand up to the governors, and this is not actually constitutional for them to do this. Refugees are admitted into the U.S., and they can go to any state that they want to. I believe that they were very well received in Connecticut, and I do believe if they had come here, they would have been well received by Hoosiers. The folks in Indiana have flooded our email and our phones with calls of support for refugees and for Syrian refugees in particular, and people wanting to give Syrian refugees a place to live and friendship and support. So I know that if they had come here, Indiana would have welcomed them like they welcome the 893 other refugees that we resettle each year.
Carlene Miller, Executive Director for Exodus Refugee Immigration. Thank you very much, Carlene.
Thank you.
There have not been many cases of refugees turned into extremists once here in the U.S., extremely rare from a statistical point of view. But there was one case a few years back. It involved two Iraqi refugees named Wad Ramadan Alwan and Mohammed Sharif Hamadi. They were resettled in Bowling Green, Kentucky, back in 2009. By 2011, they were in trouble with the law. Lisa Autry covered the case for WKU Public Radio in Bowling Green.
They basically plotted to send weapons and cash to Al-Qaeda in Iraq to support the insurgency there. And these were high-powered sniper rifles, Stinger missiles. And the money and weapons really, though, never made it to Iraq. The scheme was foiled by an FBI informant. And so they were arrested in 2011, were scheduled to go to trial, but both pleaded guilty. One was sentenced to life, the other to 40 years.
So it sounds, as you're saying, they were planning to take military hardware back to Iraq to kill Americans there. That's what the indictment suggests, but not to stage attacks here. Am I stating that accurately?
Right. None of their plots were ever intended in the U.S. They were trying to do all of this back home in Iraq.
Were they connected to any extremist organization, or were they kind of freelancing this?
They had both been involved in insurgent attacks in Iraq before coming to Bowling Green in 2009 as refugees. Alwan's fingerprints were found on an IED in Iraq back in 2005, which helped seal the case.
Given that connection to those attacks, what happened to the vetting process?
In the wake of the Kentucky case, the U.S. halted the refugee program for Iraqis for 6 months. I think some changes were made here on the local level, but as we speak, the vetting process is continuing, and of course, we've welcomed many more refugees from all over the world to Bowling Green, which is a town of about 61,000 people. We recently heard that during this fiscal year, October 1st through September 30th of next year, Bowling Green has been cleared to receive about 400 refugees, and 100 of them will be Iraqis.
You said the population of Bowling Green, about 60,000?
Yeah, so you can imagine the disbelief, the shock in hearing that, you know, someone's neighbors were involved in such an elaborate plot.
Is there a large refugee community in that population?
We do. We have a pretty large refugee population, a lot of Bosnians and Burmese, Somali. So we have a pretty large immigrant population to be a town of our size.
Right. So let's put this in the current context of things. In the wake of the Paris bombings, that Kentucky Senator Rand Paul has come out against taking in Syrian refugees. Fellow Kentuckian Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has also called for a pause and even pointed to the case of Hamadi and Alwan to say that he, quote, doesn't feel particularly comforted by the assertion that our government can vet these refugees. But for everyday folks in Bowling Green, is this on their minds right now?
I think it probably is. We harbored two dangerous people from Iraq who wanted to cause harm to American forces in Iraq. And just for that reason alone, I think a lot of people have raised eyebrows around here about the possibility of bringing in Syrian refugees. And we've learned this week that as of right now, there are no plans to bring in Syrian refugees to Bowling Green. Bowling Green is a little more wary, I believe, than other towns who maybe don't have the type of experience that we had.
And what about the majority of refugees in Bowling Green, the good apples? How did they feel when this case happened?
They were just as shocked as anyone else. It was hard to believe that anyone like that could be among us. It's very much a small sort of Mayberry-type community. They felt that a couple of bad apples gave the wrong impression of the international community here.
And do they have concerns today that that wrong impression may be kind of falling on them once again?
We've heard that just anecdotally from a few, that they hate what the Paris terrorist attacks have done as far as creating that national, international discussion about bringing in refugees who have the best intentions, have the intentions of seeking just a safe haven and starting a new life for them and their families.
Reporter Lisa Autry at public radio station WKU in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Thanks for telling us about this.
Thank you.
Another concern is that terrorists could potentially sneak into the U.S. by simply crossing over the border with Mexico. This is not a new fear, but it's resurfaced after the Paris attacks. Yesterday, five Syrian men were caught using fake Greek passports in Honduras. Authorities there say the men were hoping to travel by land to the U.S. The World's Monica Campbell is following their story.
There's no evidence at all that they're linked to terrorist cells or the Paris attacks. What we know is that several are university students, and they indicated that they wanted to go to the United States. But according to the Honduran police chief, there's no signs at all that they were connected to terrorist cells.
Traían documentación falsa, algunos pasaportes, los cuales van a ser investigados.
This was Honduran police spokesperson Anibal Baca saying that the men had false passports, stolen Greek passports, and that they were clearly not Greek and that they were being investigated.
And what were their aims in trying to get to the U.S.?
Well, the idea is that if they get to the U.S., if they get to the U.S.-Mexico border, they can present themselves to Border Patrol agents in the United States and claim asylum. And we've seen a number of people from Syria, not a huge number, but we've seen people from Syria coming through Mexico and parts of Latin America on up into the United States to make those claims, to seek safety.
Yeah, how much is this happening? I mean, are there a lot of Syrians all over South America right now trying to get perhaps to the United States?
We're seeing sporadic reports of Syrians popping up in different parts of Latin America, in different parts of South America, and they can arrive on tourist visas. You know, obviously, a Syrian can't get a U.S. tourist visa, but they can get tourist visas to other parts of the Western Hemisphere. Obviously, these men detained in Honduras are raising a red flag because they had stolen and doctored passports. What you usually see are Syrians arriving through a visa, through a tourist visa, into South America or different parts of Latin America, and then generally moving on up into the United States. Their goal is to reach the United States, although you do have some countries, Argentina, Brazil, saying Chile, for example, which has an interestingly large Arab community, saying we welcome Syrians. But those are officially, you know, resettled Syrians. Those aren't people just arriving in the airport.
If I put this in context of the flood of kids and families from Central America fleeing the violence there, it strikes me as pretty easy for lots of people to get through Central and South American borders.
The south border with Mexico and Guatemala, the southern Mexico border, it's porous, but it's also there's a real crackdown happening at the southern Mexican border. The security corridor there is definitely tightening. That also means that smugglers are taking migrants along different routes, you know, so people shift as their needs are still constant. You know, that desire to get to the United States is going to mean they're going to find a way to push through, and smugglers are going to find a way to push people through. It's a huge border, and it's still relatively porous.
The World's Monica Campbell, thank you so much for telling us about all this.
Okay, Marco, thanks.
The war in Syria has sent millions of people fleeing across the globe, and it raises so many issues. But one thing we know for sure, when the war does end, young Syrians will play a big role rebuilding their country. Tonight, I'm moderating a panel at Harvard that will highlight the perspectives of young Syrians. If you can't make it, and that might be hard if you're not in the Boston area, we'll be streaming it all online. Find out more at facebook.com/PRI the world. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We've spent the last few minutes hearing about refugees and what role the U.S. should have in resettling them, especially in light to the security concerns that have been raised after the terrorist attacks last week in Paris. One politician in Virginia has compared those concerns to the ones during World War II about Japanese Americans. He even raised the idea of internment camps. More on that in a moment. First, though, we're going to turn to Leith Anderson. He's with the National Association of Evangelicals. The organization helps with resettling refugees in the U.S. And here's what Leith Anderson sees at stake in this whole debate.
Well, I see the lives of refugees who have fled violence and threat for their family in Syria and other parts of the Middle East. And we have both an opportunity and a responsibility to be helpful to them. And we need to step up to that responsibility.
So as you've seen all this erupt in the media, what goes through your mind?
Actually, there's been so much in the media, it's kind of hard to keep track of how many governors and how many candidates are saying what. I guess I'm not particularly driven by that. I'm driven more by, as an evangelical Christian, that the Bible calls us to care for those that are in need. You know, I think of Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan, where this guy's beat up and people have all the reasons not to help him, and then comes along this Samaritan that Jesus calls good, and he risks all kinds of things, including his own money, to help somebody that was in need. And then Jesus finishes that parable by saying, go and do likewise. So we have an opportunity to go and do likewise.
I mean, Donald Trump has said he's open to some pretty draconian measures like closing mosques, making Muslims in this country carry some form of special ID. What do you think is going on here? What does this moment mean for evangelicals?
Well, evangelicals have long been involved in resettling refugees, but the other side of it is evangelical Christians are refugees around the world. So in many parts of Africa and other places, we are the ones who are in this situation. And in that situation, we want people to respond to us with compassion. We don't want to be sorted out and persecuted, so we shouldn't be doing it for other people. But I'd be far more driven by that circumstance than by, you know, the current news on any particular candidate.
And yet American Christians are not all on the same page with this. Franklin Graham, the famous evangelist, has said that America is at war with Islam and that, quote, if we continue to allow Muslim immigration, we'll see much more of what happened in France. It's on our doorstep, he said. What do you say to Christians who share his view?
Well, among all Christians, and certainly among evangelical Christians, there's a variety of opinion. And I fully understand, I think we all understand, that what happened in Paris and what happened in Lebanon has us all both sobered and frightened. So people have immediate responses to that and are concerned about what's going to happen. But we need to take a longer view. And a longer view is, in my opinion, a biblical view that says, what about these people? You know, if somebody is bleeding and comes to an emergency room, or they're hungry and they come to a food shelf, but we're not going to really ask their religion. We're going to help them stop bleeding, and we're going to feed them, and that's what we need to do. It's not everyone, but it's what we can do.
Are you facing a split among evangelicals that you worry may not be able to be resolved so quickly?
I have most heard from evangelicals who are deeply concerned for those who are in need and have, you know, listened to what they have to say. Actually, I hope I've rooted my opinions in what the Bible says and not this different factions. But no, I've not significantly heard from those who want to keep all refugees out.
Leith Anderson with the National Association of Evangelicals. Thanks very much for your time.
Good to talk to you, Marco.
One person who does want to stop refugee resettlement is Mayor David Bowers of Roanoke, Virginia. He heard the debate over Syrian refugees now and thought of Japanese Americans during World War II. He's even mentioned the internment camps many Japanese Americans were confined to decades ago. Numerous people have called the mayor out for this. We thought it'd be useful to remember what it was like in those camps. George Nakashima knows. He and his wife were forced into a camp in Idaho starting in 1942. Nakashima is considered one of the greatest American craftsmen of the 20th century. You can find his furniture at the Met in New York. He died in 1990, but his daughter, Mira Nakashima, keeps his legacy alive. She's the artistic director at George Nakashima Woodworker in New Hope, Pennsylvania. I asked Mira what her parents told her about their internment.
It's interesting you should ask that question because nobody wanted to talk about it. I found out indirectly that my mother basically had a mental breakdown. I was a newborn baby, and we were put into the camps, and there were pretty awful toilet facilities, and was a mess hall with food that none of us Japanese Americans ate. My mom even had trouble getting formula for me. So I remember having to drink a teaspoon of cod liver oil every day because I had rickets. So I was probably malnourished while we were in the camps. And I have bone problems that probably were caused by lack of good nutrition while we were in camp.
Bone problems today?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, these mostly Japanese Americans were prisoners without committing a crime. Did they have to give up personal property before?
Oh, they lost everything.
Everything?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were only given 2 weeks to evacuate. So you had to get rid of everything you had in 2 weeks.
Wow.
So people bought stuff for ridiculous amounts of money and froze the Japanese Americans' bank accounts so they couldn't do anything or save anything. But and then there were some people who said, oh, we will keep this for you, and then they just moved in and took over and never gave it back.
I mean, your father, George Nakashima, was a well-respected architect and designer with an MIT pedigree. He studied in France. He must have found this just unbelievably insulting.
He probably did, but he didn't talk about it.
Yeah. Again, you don't really know. In the long term, how do you think it impacted your life, considered you don't really remember a lot of this because you were so young?
I think it impacted me in subtle ways, more subliminal ways than conscious ways.
Like how?
Like I don't have a lot of self-confidence.
You trace it back to the internment camps.
I think so. I mean, when you are incarcerated, even though I was little, just knowing, you know, little bits and pieces of history, you know, I think it has influenced me. It's interesting. Dad said his wounds healed and left no scars. And I don't know if he was just trying to justify what had happened and prove that he was just as good afterwards as he was before. And the WRA came and took pictures of us after we moved to New Hope. And I think it was kind of a publicity thing.
WRA? What is that?
The World Relocation Authority. No, the War Relocation Authority.
Mm.
They were trying to prove that the incarceration didn't do anybody any harm, that we were fine, we were well, we were doing well in Pennsylvania, and we had our own little cottage, and Dad was establishing his furniture business, and everything was fine, and nobody was hurt. And,
yeah,
you know,
so when you see politicians now essentially saying the internment camps protected America, what goes through your head?
It's a lie. It's an outright lie. There was no, as I said, there was no evidence of any intrigue or interest from the Japanese American community to join Japan in the war against America. There was absolutely no evidence whatsoever.
Mira Nakashima, who was interned with her mother and father in 1942, she's now the artistic director at George Nakashima Woodworker in New Hope, Pennsylvania. Mira, thanks so much for your thoughts.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. ISIS is not the only group recruiting young people to its cause. In Somalia, many end up joining groups like Al-Shabaab.
We often believe that if our child is becoming very invested into the mosque or into Islam, that this is not something they should ever question.
Saving Somalia's radicalized youth, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The Paris attacks have stoked all kinds of fears, including the fear that ISIS or other extremist groups could use chemical or biological weapons. Officials in France have raised the possibility. And on Saturday, the French Ministry of Health issued a decree allowing emergency services to buy, stock, and administer atropine sulfate. That's an antidote to nerve gas. The decree noted that the measure was being taken ahead of the upcoming climate change summit in Paris.
The threat of nerve agent, I think, is maybe a little bit of a stretch. It's very difficult to produce nerve agent unless you've found some.
That's Paul Walker. He's a chemical weapons expert with the nonprofit Global Green in Washington. But he says other chemical weapons cannot be ruled out.
Mustard agent is not hard to produce. Chlorine is not hard to find. It's everywhere, as you know, as an industrial chemical. And both chlorine and mustard agent have been used, we believe, by ISIS in very limited ways with very limited impact to date in Iraq and potentially in Syria.
How easy are chemical weapons to transport if they wanted to get them to Europe?
They're fairly – as long as you have them in sealed containers. Otherwise, you're in danger, obviously, the people handling them. But if it's some sort of a sealed container, maybe it's an old weapon from Saddam Hussein or, you know, it can be bottled – you know, in a Coke bottle, or it could be bottled in anything else. So, you know, I've been working on chemical weapons well over 20 years now and the elimination of them. And we've been successful in eliminating, you know, over 65,000 metric tons in in 10 million weapons all over the world. So it's not like these are, unique or hard to come by.
So as to that decree from the French Ministry of Health, I mean, is it unusual for medical services to have atropine sulfate on hand? I mean, it sounds from this decree like it's pretty unusual to have it, administer it, unless there's some special reason.
It is. And I think it is unusual. It's not usually available. But if you ever visit a chemical weapons stockpile, as, you know, a few of us have, for better or for worse over the years, you always carry atropine with you. But it's useful really only as a very immediate antidote to nerve agent weapons. I mean, you have to inject the atropine in your partner or in yourself, whoever has been affected by a leak of nerve agent, within seconds, you know, no more than a minute.
What about a chlorine attack? Is that also deadly?
It's potentially deadly, but not nearly as much. I mean, a nerve agent like sarin is probably well over, 100 times more deadly. Chlorine is an asphyxiating agent. It seeps into your lungs if you take a deep breath. If you get a really full dose of chlorine, it can provide long-term respiratory problems, but is unlikely to kill you. But it can cause panic, obviously, very heavy panic if you can't breathe very well. So chlorine is probably the most likely use of a chemical agent that would cause panic and potentially, injury and death in the widespread panic that would take place. But it itself probably would not kill too many people. Mustard agent is a blister agent. It's an older weapon, that was used in World War I. That's a blister agent so that if it touches your skin, it gives you really heavy, bad burns. And I've seen, unexploded ordnance teams, for example, who've stepped in mustard agent by mistake or handled a broken weapon by mistake, a leaking weapon, and their hands will blow up, literally to the size of a football, and they'll have to be hospitalized for, months to try to survive.
Paul, you've got some grim scenarios. How likely is any of this?
We know the terrorists have always wanted to do an event or events with weapons of mass destruction. Chemical weapons are the most easy and likely way, easiest to obtain. So I think if they're heading that direction, I think it's likely they could at least have a chlorine attack. I think it's also likely, more than a 50% chance probably they could have a mustard agent, a blister agent attack. I think it's less likely to have an effective nerve agent attack, probably down to the 10 or 15% level. Yeah, I think there's a good possibility. It could be an event of this type.
Paul Walker, a chemical weapons expert with the nonprofit group, Global Green in Washington, D.C. Not a very pretty prognosis, but thanks for speaking with us anyway.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
As France struggles to cope with the aftermath of last week's attacks, one political party there expects to capitalize on growing fears about immigration and radical Islam. The World's Leo Hornack spent an evening with members of the youth wing of the far-right National Front, or as it's known there, Le Front National.
In some ways, the clubroom here in the 13th arrondissement of Paris feels like youth clubs everywhere. Coca-Cola in plastic cups, awkward flirting near the snack bar, and on the walls, a poster with the slogan, 100% Front National, 0% Migrant. Véronique Fournilly is one of the organisers of tonight's gathering.
We're normal people, young people. We're totally normal people. We go to the movies and we go have some drinks sometimes.
All political parties have agreed to suspend campaigning for next month's regional elections as part of France's national emergency after the attacks. But this might be Véronique and her friend's moment. The Front National leader, Marine Le Pen, has built a career out of trying to bring her far-right party into the mainstream of French politics. She was third in the first round of the 2012 presidential election. And the message for years has been that France's future is under threat from immigration, and particularly Muslim immigration.
I know from some friends that we have had a lot of people wanting to join since Friday.
And why is that?
I think a lot of people remember that National Front has warned them a long time ago about the danger of immigration and Islamism in France. So they see that we were right all along, and they also see that our government has failed to protect us.
You know, some people do say, some people think that it's a racist organization and that it still is hostile to other cultures. You know, what would be your answer to that?
I would answer to them to just write what we propose, because there is absolutely nothing racist about it. And there is a lot of people from different cultures, from different countries, who are joining us.
Cédric Cassané is another of the local Front National activists. He works near one of the cafes that was attacked by gunmen last Friday. He says he heard the gunshots and the sirens before his Facebook feed started going crazy. But he and his friends weren't surprised by the news.
We were a bit prepared for this tragedy. In comparison to the rest of the population of Paris, we are not shocked.
The evening's lectures begin in the clubroom. An invited author speaks at length about the history of the French language, the greatness of French culture. On the surface, it's all quite dry, quite academic, a long way from the demagoguery or table thumping that you might expect from a radical party known for its anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic views. But that's the point, says Cédric. This is a long-term strategy. They're preparing to govern. He plans to run for election eventually. On the wall across the room is another campaign poster. It shows a young woman with the French flag painted on her face, and next to her, a woman wearing a burqa. The slogan? Choose your ghetto. Vote Front National.
Choose between the French culture, the French values, or choose for Islamic laws.
Is that really the choice that people face in France? Front National or Sharia law?
I think yes, because we try to defend the French values and we struggle against the Islamic culture.
Back in the clubroom, the speaker's wrapping up with a Q&A. I find myself scanning the titles on the bookshelves near where I'm sitting. Things like, will the 21st century be the Muslim century? And lots of books on French history. And then this happens. The speaker asks the group, who's going to forbid me from being a racist? Someone in the audience says with a laugh, Taubira. That's France's socialist justice minister, Christiane Taubira. She's black. Then the speaker responds, C'est Guénon, that's she monkey. And the crowd laughs. For the world, I'm Leo Hornack, Paris.
When France announced earlier that the man suspected of organizing the Paris attacks was killed in a raid, Belgium breathed a sigh of relief. The justice minister said the death of Abdelhamid Abaoud removes the spider in the web of an ISIS network based in Brussels. The world's Jeb Sharp is in Brussels reporting on the links to radical extremists there. But today she bumped into someone she knows from here in Boston and was struck by how deeply the Paris attacks have affected him.
Nasser Wadadi is the sort of person you want to talk to after something like Paris. He's Mauritanian-American. He knows the Middle East and North Africa. He's an expert on radicalization and social media. He moves in many worlds, serving as a cultural broker, helping people understand one another. He spoke at the interfaith service that helped bring Bostonians together after the marathon attacks. But after Paris, he's at a loss. It just feels like Groundhog Day to him.
Since 9/11, seeing the same thing, the same cycle, terrorist attacks, anger, people trying to understand, people trying to fix it, and yet 14 years later, here we are again. Total frustration. I spent the last year I was working on the attempt of rescuing American hostages held by ISIS. I feel terrible. At times I would say, confused is not the word. It's like basically a sense of where do we begin?
Where do we begin? Because all Wadadi can see is a massive failure. He blames the Obama administration for not acting sooner in Syria to stop the rise of ISIS there. But he also sees failures in the communities where young people continue to be radicalized. He finds it infuriating that we've done so much work to understand how young people become radicalized, and yet we still aren't preventing it from happening.
What is really bugging me is that, again, I come 15 years through, governments, local civil society still do not know how to do it, even though that we have blueprints of how to do that. We have tools that could be deployed. For example, in a neighborhood like Molenbeek, and by the way, there are many Molenbeeks all over Europe, and by the way, in the Arab world, by the way, in North America. What it means is that basically we know how to engage youth. We know how to help them organize and fill the vacuum that is being taken over by Islamist radicals. we know how to shut the door to the recruiters.
In Wadadi's view, it's not rocket science either. It's literally engaging youth, building youth centers, talking about religion, not shying away from their questions about Islam, being in touch with them, and communities working hand in hand with authorities to communicate crucial information. Instead, Wadadi sees paralysis.
The fundamental goal is to enlist these communities, to be actually partners, willing partners, of doing the prevention work needed to stop the process of radicalization, or contain those who are already radicalized, or de-escalate. Because at the end of the day, I don't care how many resources, there's no security force in the world with all the intelligence, eavesdropping, spying techniques that you can deploy that can infiltrate fully a community. It's been tried. It failed.
Nasser Wadadi spends his life trying to understand the ideology that drives the terrorism in hopes of persuading people to steer away from it. But he wants his leaders to take action, not study the problem the way he does.
I don't want my daughter to be blown up tomorrow. I need that to be stopped. And that's what I need from my leaders. I need them to actually be leaders instead of trying to be philosophers and anthropologists. Leave that to me. You do the leadership.
Nasser Wadadi is sick of saying the same things over and over, but he's got nonstop meetings here in Brussels to try to share what he's learned and make a difference. For The World, I'm Jeb Sharp in Brussels.
Tomorrow will mark 1 week since the Paris attacks, and we'll continue to cover that story from all angles for some time to come. But let's check in on some other news, starting with this. The World Health Organization sounded the alarm today about drug-resistant superbugs. The problem is fueled by the overuse and misuse of antibiotics around the globe. Officials say drug-resistant infections already result in hundreds of thousands of deaths each year. The WHO says a global push to change people's behavior is needed to prevent the crisis from escalating dangerously. From superbugs to a super diamond, news out of Botswana today of an 1,100-carat diamond that's just been discovered. It's said to be the second largest gem-quality diamond ever found. The largest was mined in South Africa over a century ago. It was later cut up into several gems, some of which still adorn Britain's crown jewels. These days, though, Botswana is the world's leading diamond producer. Diamonds always feature prominently in James Bond movies. The latest release, Spectre, has topped the box office here in the U.S. for 2 weeks already. In India, the film comes out tomorrow, and when it does, it will be a little shorter. India's film censors have ordered that the kissing scenes be trimmed. That includes at least two smooches between lead actors Daniel Craig and Monica Bellucci. Some Indians quickly ridiculed the move on Twitter. One Bollywood director wrote, "James Bond's women must be feeling so safe now that our censor board is there to protect their honor from that creep." By the way, the censors didn't chop anything else from Spectre, so rest assured, Indian moviegoers, all the shootouts and explosions you expect in a Bond thriller, they made the deli cut. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. News of the Paris attacks last Friday ricocheted around the world almost instantaneously. 26-year-old Ilwad Elman caught the bulletins at home on her TV in Mogadishu, Somalia. She was with her mother, Fartoun Aden, who saw reports flash on her Twitter feed.
Our reaction was thinking, what is going on? We never expected that's going to happen to a Western country.
Mother and daughter were both born in Somalia, but they left for Canada after Fartoun's husband, Ilwad's dad, was killed in 1996. He was a legendary peace activist in Somalia. Ilwad grew up in Ottawa, but she and her mother were not content with a comfortable life in Canada. They returned to Somalia to create the Elman Peace and Human Rights Center. From their base in Mogadishu, they work with women who've been abused and raped. They also reach out to the families who've lost sons and daughters to the Somali extremist group Al-Shabaab. This week, the pair traveled to Massachusetts to receive an award for their work from Harvard's Kennedy School. They also dropped by our studio, where Fartoun told me she sees the Paris attack as further proof that many jihadi groups have a truly global reach.
We thought we are in Somalia, we are risky, but that is an eye-opening to all of us, to say anything can happen anywhere.
What about you, Ilwad? What did you think when you heard about Paris and the attacks last Friday? How did you react?
We're not safe anywhere, and I think that violent extremism is definitely the most pressing concern of our generation globally.
I mean, eye-opening, not necessarily for people who live in Mogadishu, but certainly eye-opening for Paris that this can happen anywhere. You both do so much important work on extremist movements. Let's focus on that, especially your work rehabilitating youth who join extremist groups. Have you seen a lot of successful recruiting by al-Shabaab in Somalia and in Western countries where Somalis live? And how does this group actually win over young men and women?
Some of this we attribute to the savior complex that we're seeing young people adopting, where they think that by joining al-Shabaab, it's a nationalistic movement for them and saving Somalia. So there's that aspect of it. But we also see young people that are pulled because they just don't have any other alternatives inside Somalia.
You know, the one of the thing now in Somalia is we don't see is the family who actually fighting with Shabaab, who wanted their kids to pull out. Mothers who actually talking to their kids saying, please come back. Don't go there. And when the kids comes back, they're always thinking, okay, I'm here with you, but what should I do? What is my choices? And that is the people we always advocating to help. It was a one story. It was a young guy. His name is Abdullahi. He came to me and he said, my mom was calling me. She is a diabetic. She was saying, please come back. I came to her. What should I do now? I can't sit there and waiting for her to support me. I'm supposed to help her. So what should I do?
Ilwad, I mean, how do you take a young man like that who is drawn in for economic reasons, pulled out because he has to help his mother, and then wonders, how do I do this?
Al-Shabaab is a type of group that once you leave, it's only under two circumstances. You're either dead or you're in jail. There's no defecting from them and being safe in the community. So a lot of the work that we have to do with reintegrating these young people is a component of giving them an economic opportunity, but also making sure that they have community-based protection mechanisms that are in place for them. So their reintegration process for us is giving them technical skills so that they have skills to support themselves with economically, but also making sure that they have life skills so that they can thrive in their communities once they are reintegrated. So if you have someone that has lived that experience, have gone through it, have become injured during battle, and then have been abandoned by the group, now having means of supporting themselves, telling others to leave, it's a lot more powerful than al-Shabaab.
When the kids are with Shabaab, they don't listen to music. They're not allowed to play a football. They don't allow. So when they come to you and you see this, they really enjoying it. They play the music. One story was they were playing the music, it's very loud. And then I said, please calm down. This is too much. And they said, who you scared? We the one who are scared. And they need small things. It doesn't cost us a lot. Playing the football and listen to the music. That's what they're looking for. And having the education. In Somalia, we don't have education. And I think when we're talking about peace, we always concentrate the old man. We don't see the young guys who really need to talk about this issue and be inclusive and listen to them.
I would guess that this conversation is a pretty difficult one to get started with kids, also the parents who probably don't want to take on Shabaab. But I gather one of the things that you've done is created a questionnaire for mothers who are worried about their sons and daughters. How does that actually work? What does this questionnaire actually do?
A lot of this is focused on pulling back kids that are already with al-Shabaab. We've seen that happen, that success, time and time again, where children, like the example that Fortune just gave of Abdullahi leaving al-Shabaab because his mother reached out to him. She was on the phone with him all the time telling him, leave the group, leave the group. So this questionnaire, what it does is it helps mothers to really make sure that they ask questions that force their child to respond in a way that makes them reflect on their situation, but also gives them an action-based response of, if they don't want to leave, why don't they want to leave? And then counter that for them to really understand why they still are with the group.
If a young man decides to join a more conservative mosque or a masjid, a parent tells him not to? I mean, wouldn't the young person just say, well, I'm being more holy? I mean, how do you even counter that?
This is one of the uncomfortable truths. We often believe that if our child is becoming very invested into the mosque or into Islam, that this is not something that you should ever question. In many ways, it's considered blasphemy. Why would you question this? He's going down the holy path. So what we encourage families to also do is to address some of those uncomfortable truths. It's okay for you to question your child if they are becoming too obsessed with a new religious mentor. We're not saying that Islam is the root of terrorism, because it most certainly is not. But there is a radical extreme ideology in Islam that is perverted sometimes to radicalize young people. And in order to tackle this, we have to encourage that parents ask questions when their kids leave the homes.
I mean, Fartoon, how do you see that as a mother? I mean, you have a kid who's suddenly becoming more reverent. Is it your role to step in and say, no, don't become more reverent?
It's true. It's very difficult. You're not going to say, don't go to the mosque, because it's like you're feeling like this is the wrong thing to say. But at the same time, when you see the situation we're going in right now, a lot of families are talking to the kid and knowing what they're doing and who they're going with.
Nobody gets radicalized overnight. It's a process, whether it's through social media at home, whether it's interactions they have with different people that have radical views. But if we invest more time of empowering mothers and families in the home to ask questions of their children, we can prevent these things.
Yeah, we are hopeful, and I think we can. It takes time, but we will see the change. In Somalia, we'll get change.
Fartoon Aden and Ilwad Elman, her daughter, who are from Mogadishu and with the Elman Peace and Human Rights Center there. Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having us here.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.